Projektionen, Kinogespräche wird präsentiert von podriders.de, das Podcast-Netzwerk.
Herzlich willkommen zu Positionen, der Sondersendung der Projektionen Kinogespräche, dem Podcast von Markus Stiegelecker und Sebastian Seidler. Die Positionen sind ein Sonderformat, in dem wir uns externe Gäste einladen und mit diesen Gästen über spezielle filmbezogene Themen sprechen. Und heute möchte ich einen Gast vorstellen, der mit mir über die Bedeutung des Genre-Kinos im Kontext der italienischen Filmproduktion, vor allem der 60er und 70er Jahre, sprechen wird. Es handelt sich um den italienischen Filmhistoriker Eugenio Ercolani. Und ich werde mit ihm aus der Perspektive des Filmwissenschaftlers mit genre-theoretischem Hintergrund sprechen. Ich bin ja Herausgeber des Handbuchs Filmgenre und Eugenio Ercolani ist der Verfasser des Buches Darkening the Italian Screen. Interviews with Genre and Exploitation Directors who debuted in the 50s and 60s. Das ist ein Buch, das er als Interviewer und Autor geschrieben hat, das bei Macfarlane erschienen ist und erhältlich ist. Now I change to English because the whole talk will be in English, and I welcome Eugenio Ercolani from Rome, but sitting in London at the moment. Hello.
Hello to all. It's good to be participating in this. Very excited about being here, and I'm sure we have a lot to say. I didn't catch everything Marcus just said. But thank you for the introduction, nonetheless.
It was all nice things.
I take your word. Thank you.
So we actually wrote a book together. I didn't mention that. We wrote a book on the film Cruising by William Friedkin together, which is out on in the series Devil's Advocates on Liverpool University Press. And you might be interested in that. Probably, I hope so, after our talk now. But the topic will be slightly different at the moment because I invited you because you have a very special, special position in a way, because your family background is actually situated in Italian film history. So yeah. You're coming from a film family, if I can say that. Probably you can introduce that a little bit.
Yes. Well, my grandfather on my mother's side is Giulio Petroni. He is not probably the flashiest of names, but most people, especially fans of Westerns, of Italian spaghetti Westerns, will be very much aware of his work. He actually began his career in as a film critic and then as a writer and also art critic, apart from film critic, and write and then subsequently first AD and then a documentary maker in the 50s, a very prolific documentary maker. So much so that he was nominated various times in the 50s at the Edinburgh Film Festival and won actually Best Short Film, because at the time in Italy, cortometraggi, short films, was the word to indicate short documentaries, basically. Documentaries were called short films. And he won the Venice Film Festival and then made his debut in 1959 behind the camera in feature-length fictional work and became well-known in the Western genre thanks to Death Rides a Horse, Da Uomo a Uomo. I think in Germany it was released as Mann zu Mann, something like that.
Sorry, Mann zu Mann, yeah, that could be, yeah.
And of course, we all know that the soundtrack composed by Morricone was then later used in at least two Quentin Tarantino films, one being Kill Bill Volume 1 and subsequently Inglourious Basterds, after the success of Death Rides a Horse. Giulio will make another four films within the genre, among which Te Pepa, Blood and Guns, aka Viva la Rivolution, with Orson Welles and Thomas Emilian. A very successful film, in fact, in Germany, his last Western, and the least favorite among the ones he had done is the film he had problems with, which is Providenza, which was quite a hit in Germany, as I was saying, with again with Milian and American character actor Greg Palmer. So yes, and then he continued. He was active in other genres as well, comedy, drama. He also made a very particular, very strange kind of mix, contaminated erotic drama with kind of giallo overtones, which is called Lips of Lurid Blue, Labbra di Lurido Blu, with Lisa Gastoni and Corrado Pani and the British actor Jeremy Kemp. Again with Morricone, I think all in all they worked six times together, Giulio and Ennio Morricone. So he definitely left a big mark on the Western genre. And in fact, I mentioned Te Pepa, which was released in a wonderful edition in Germany in Blu-ray, in a series called, I think, Westerns Unchained or Spaghetti Westerns Unchained. There were various Tonino Valeri films. There was a Castellari film within that lot. And that same year, in fact, with that same film, my mother made her debut in films as a script supervisor. She, of course, worked other times with her father, with my grandfather, but she worked with many other directors throughout the 70s, among which Fernando Di Leo, which, of course, is one of the biggest name in Italian noir, thanks to films such as The Boss and Caliber 9. And she did several films with him, and also other directors. She continued to do westerns as well. And she worked twice with Andy Warhol on the Blood for Dracula and Flesh for Frankenstein films, directed by Paul Morrissey with Joe D'Alessandro and Daria Di Lazzaro, and a whole array of names and in cameo, various cameo roles. So that's kind of where my family was, bang in the middle of genre cinema. Then my grandfather in the early 80s, his very last film was in the mid 80s, but it was a kind of a weak and unsuccessful attempt to go back under the limelight and kind of relaunch his film career. It was unsuccessful. But by the 80s, he kind of concentrated solely on his work as a writer, which he will do practically until he died in 2010. He died in January 2010 at the age of 92, I think. Yeah, 92. But he had already started writing in the late 50s. His first novel, in fact, came out the same year of his first feature-length film in 1959. So between my mother and my grandfather, I think they've worked on approximately about 60 films, 70 films between them. So yes, and I personally started out in films as a assistant director and the first AD. And I worked in that role for quite a while, but a little less than a decade. And then I kind of slowly transitioned into, I've never been a film critic. My approach has always been that of a film historian.
And you actually studied film in London. Where was that?
I did study film at the London Film Academy, the LFA, which is situated in London, yes. And I did that. And that's where I started working. In fact, I started working in films in London, and quite prolifically, actually. A lot of short films, a lot of documentaries, a couple of feature length. Then I went back to Italy and started working there again in films. And until I started working for a magazine, which kind one could consider the Italian equivalent of the American Fangoria, or the actually better still, the French Mad Movies. It's the Italian equivalent of Mad Movies, which is called Notturno Cinema. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 8 years. I covered Cannes for them, Venice Film Festival. I wrote quite definitely, I was definitely very prolific. Until I started working on more international projects. And now my, as you know, as business people, business-oriented people say, kind of my core activity, my core business now is extras, booklets, featurettes, specials, documentaries for various European and American DVD and Blu-ray labels. And yes, as you mentioned, I did. I kind of picked up on one thing you said in the introduction, because it's the only part I understood is darkening the Italian screen. So yes, I did write my first book in 2019. It was released at the end of 2019, which is Darkening the Italian Screen, which is kind of a compendium collection of essays on film analysis and interviews with film directors, but not only, there are also actors in there, production designers, DOPs, but mostly directors, their career interviews, so they kind of touch upon everything they've done, every film, and not only films they directed, their beginnings as writers, as ADs, and or in more technical roles, sometimes as directors of photography or editors. And there are quite a few big names among there. There's Sergio Martino and Umberto Lenzi and Enzo G. Castellari. And there's also my grandfather. There's, I think, the longest interview out there available. Not the only one, but definitely the most complete interview on his Westerns. So, yeah. So that's each mm-hmm. chapter is dedicated to a different director. There is basically each chapter has the same structure. It's a long kind of essay on the director's career but especially on the context, the political, social context in which that director kind of moved and mm-hmm. evolved within. And then we pass to the interview, which touches all the roles that figure has touched. And I also try to comment on the death of Italian genre cinema and kind of the importance of a political affiliation. You know, how important was it at the time to be politically active and aligned, and how genre or exploitation directors were perceived by the kind of the Roman, especially Roman intelligentsia, mm-hmm. and how the film critics approached their work. That's a book that's been available for now a year, and people seem to like it. It was published in the United States by McFarland Company Press, and hopefully there'll be a second part.
All right, yeah. As you mentioned, a lot of things I would like to refer to, especially. If you talk to someone about the Italian cinema of the 60s, 50s, 60s, most people will come up, okay, there was, after the war, there was the neorealism, and there was this new modern cinema by Antonioni, and there was the cinema by Pasolini and Visconti. And you come up with a book featuring mainly genre and exploitation directors. That's a fact which is there. Which raises probably some questions by people who have a very conservative idea of film history. Now, I am the editor of the German Handbook of Genre Theory, and there is three parts. It's theoretical approaches, it's national approaches, and it's certain genre-specific approaches. So it's three parts in that book. And the national approaches, there you see that each country has a kind of a parallel phenomenon of a genre-based film history and an auteur film art-based history. And it became kind of a common sense to focus on the auteur-based, the masterpiece, classic history of film, and a kind of an arrogant idea of what the rest might be and whoever would be interested in that. So what you do, and also in part what I do, is getting a new focus, another focus on film history as genre history. So coming from this angle, in Germany, as you obviously know, because there's connections to Italian film, after the Second World War, we had a huge genre-based film industry in Germany, focusing on like the homeland films, the Heimat films, and German war films, and also starting in the late 50s, the Edgar Wallace crimi features, which become quite popular because in America, for example, there are now there are people being interested in these films because Tarantino and all those cinephiles are mentioning and referring to the German crimis of the 60s especially. And if you get into this and the Euro-Western, you mentioned the Italian Western, there are also German Western, like the Winnetou films and all these Karl May adaptations. So you get another image of the German film as well, because most people think, German film of that time, it's Fassbinder, Alexander Kluge, Schlöndorff, Wim Wenders, and all these people. And actually, people were not mainly in the cinema to watch films by those guys, which are really respectable, it's no question. But people went into cinema to see Edgar Wallace films, to see Karl May adaptations, and finally to see the sex films like the Schoolgirl Report films and all these things. These were really successful. So, as you said, you discussed in your book, you discussed how Italian films reflected the state of Italian politics and society. I would consider that a kind of film sociological approach as a subtext. Would you say that Italian genre cinema has a very special meaning which was overseen till now? Or how would you say, what is the meaning of genre for Italian cinema history?
Well, it's very schizophrenic in a way, the perception of both international, so within the Italian, within Italy, but also counterbalancing it with the foreign, German, American, and British approach. For example, from outwards looking into Italy, there's this perception that everything apart from Rossellini, Pasolini, Antonioni, and Fellini is pretty much all the same thing. You know, it's all a one big cauldron, which is separated and very different from anything else, from art house and auteur films. It's all exploitation. There's never been an attempt to really dig into that cauldron and start dividing and kind of understanding the production hummus, you know, that the soil from which these films grew and flourished. And in fact, you know, there's exploitation, there are B-movies, there's genre films, that has never been done. And this is also because often from distributors, international distributors, there wasn't really an attempt to understand what they were marketing. The dubbing, the choice of the film poster and the title, you know, everything was kind of, these films were in some way dismantled and put together to fit what was more marketable on each country, on each market. So you see films that get Italian genre films that actually had a sense of purpose and ambition, that you see them dismantled and kind of restyled for the German market, and then again for the American market, or the British or the French, often distributors, without even the permission of the directors, would insert erotic or even pornographic elements to make the films more marketable. So I think that from the international perspective, looking into Italian films, there's a lot of confusion. But the confusion you can find also within the Italian kind of film historians, intelligentsia, and the film critics. What is interesting to really understand is that a lot of these kind of categories and these labels, these very kind of loose and easy labels that are put on films, actually are sometimes extremely arbitrary and have to do more for example, in Italy, the perceived notion that films have to have a political content. So if they don't have a political content, I mean, we have to also consider that Italy was, after the Second World War, became the biggest communist country in Europe after the Soviet Union. And very much the cinema and the film industry was under the extreme left-wing kind of intelligentsia. You know, a film, a song, a book, if it didn't have a political backbone, no matter how good the quality was, it was pure entertainment. And pure entertainment equals B-movie, equals exploitation, equals something that is not worthy of analysis. Italy is a highly politicized country. It always has been highly politicized. Everything is political in Italy. What you choose to eat, how you choose to dress, what kind of music you listen to determines if you want it or not. Even if you don't have a political consciousness, it determines where you stand politically and what political flag you are wearing. And this is was very much true after the war. It became even truer in the 60s and 70s. And no matter what, that's what's funny, that interviewing many of these directors and passing a lot of days and hours and sometimes weeks with them, you realize that often this perception we have of them politically has nothing to do with their actual values, because we've applied this in Italy, this notion that, you know, these directors should probably think or believe certain things just on the basis of the fact that their films do not have a blatant political consciousness. So pure entertainment is evil. That is the bottom line. And if we start seeing that as something that is applied and has nothing to do with the actual film industry and the production system that created these films, we stop and realize that these directors actually are within the system, are just film directors. You know, Alberto De Martino, who's one of the directors in my book, for example, and there's a very long chapter about him. Alberto De Martino used to be the dubbing director for Federico Fellini, and he was the dubbing director of La Dolce Vita. We see that Ruggero Deodato, who everybody knows for Cannibal Holocaust, used to be the first AD of Roberto Rossellini, of neorealism. And actually was Roberto Rossellini's first AD on several films, and was very much close to the Rossellini family. One of his best friends was Renzo Rossellini, Roberto's son. So, and again, we see Giulio Petroni, my grandfather. He was the first AD of Giuseppe De Santis, and again, actually, of Rossellini in the 40s, but especially with De Santis, who was the father of the pink Nihilism, as it was called, kind of the melodrama of the melodramatic side of Nihilism. And he directed, you know, an important, very important film called Driso Amaro, Bitter Rice. Mm-hmm. So we actually see that within the industry, all these directors, the high and the low, the auteurs and the exploitation mongers, they were all working within a very, very closed, very tight-knit system. That, and all these kind of labelings are pretty much arbitrary. And in fact, we noticed that actually the political value of these films is incredible now. I mean, if we had to trace the evolution of the morals and values and censorship of Italy and Europe as you know, as a whole, we'd actually go and watch these films rather than the films of the auteurs, you know. And that's not, I'm not saying that it's in any way that Deodato, Sergio Corbucci, or whoever is more important than I don't know, Luciano Emmer or Antonioni. But what I'm saying is that actually these films and these directors photographed more willingly than we think. This is not casual. They photographed the evolution of an entire country, political, social evolution, very well. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this very kind of neat idea you were talking about, you know, the evolution in the neorealism after the war, and this idea, this very neat and very clear and not at all ambiguous history of Italian cinema after the war. So the neorealism arrives, then, you know, Commedia all'Italiana, so the Dino Risis, the Mario Monicellis, and the Luciano Salces. It's all wonderful, but actually, if we stop and zoom into that, we realize that after the war, Italy was famished, was hungry for a cinema that was pure entertainment, because their American films were banned in Italy during the 20 years of fascism, of Mussolini's dictatorship. And so, actually, if we go and see the among the first structures, because Italy was destroyed after the war, completely destroyed, it was on its knees, and it's only thanks to its geographical, geopolitical collocation that it managed to kind of got fed with money from United States and managed to rebuild itself. And it was pivotal during the Cold War. Kind of Italy became, you know, got put into America's pocket in many ways. But the first things to be reconstructed were cinemas, cinema theaters, new modern ones compared to the ones that had been before, bigger and comfier, and a lot of them. And through the United States, Italy was flooded with these melodramas and adventure films. And before, cinema was very much prolific during the 20 years of fascism, because Mussolini firmly believed that cinema was an incredibly important propaganda machine, and so worked a lot, pumped up a lot of money into cinema. But they were all propaganda films, war films or comedies, it doesn't matter. They were all extremely, let's say, fascist. And so if we stop and see the neorealist movement created by Rossellini, and of course, you know, there were many directors that worked within the new Vittorio De Sica, of course, is my personal favorite. But they actually didn't, the neorealist movement didn't last that much. And if we see between 1945 and 1950-51, we see that actually Italy started doing immediately adventure films. Riccardo Freda did two films in those 5 years, adventure films I'm talking about. Primo Zeglio, Carmine Gallone, Carlo Ludovico Bragaglia. There are a lot of directors, some of which were new. Others instead came from the silent era and from the 20 years of fascist cinema, and recycled themselves to make films that whip your entertainment. The Neorealist movement had a great political value because it commented on what was happening. It was a reflection of the times, and people needed to see what had happened to them on the screen. They needed that kind of psychodrama in a way, and they needed to reflect and comment on it. But entertainment cinema, pure entertainment cinema, started immediately after the war.
So basically what you say is, and what I had in mind as well, is that if you want to understand how Italian cinema actually works, it is not enough to focus on the famous, world famous directors, but you have to see the whole picture because it's so much intertwined. There are so much many connections between them and an exchange of people actually working in the same business, but producing different versions of similar messages. So I wouldn't say that applies for German genre cinema as well, because there are sometimes connections between people like the Fassbinder family and Uli Lommel's exploitation films. So it happens as well. But the Italian cinema has had such a successful way of producing such a huge amount of commercial cinema from the late 50s, let's say, to the late 70s, early 80s. So it's a phenomenon within Europe. Italian genre cinema matters because it's so huge. And it is also connected to international co-productions, Germany, France, Spain, especially, and some connections to Yugoslavia as well. So what we see here is kind of a global approach from a very small country, actually, compared to others. And we mentioned exploitation and genre cinema. Exploitation is also present as a phenomenon in American cinema from the beginning in the 60s, like the exploitation of certain topics to have a very sensational and extreme cinema, which might gain success from curious audiences being entertained by extreme topics. But genre cinema has very many faces. As I understand, the idea of genre in Italy is a little bit different, and the phrase filone is not very much known outside of Italy, and especially not to film scholars internationally. It happens, but can you comment on the relation between the idea of genre cinema and filone in Italy?
Yes. Well, what is interesting about genre cinema in Italy is the fact that it very much worked as a virus, meaning that we see a pattern that repeats throughout every single genre. And from that genre, the various filoni come out. Basically, what we see is we have a generation, the first generation of directors that kind of look for the easiest approach, which was basically a derivative approach, trying to imitate the American imprint on that. We see it with peplums, because after the Hollywood on the Tiber years, so when all the Americans came in the 50s to Italy and started making loads of films, American productions, but all set in Italy with Italian, at Cinecittà, with Italian crews, often even a lot of Italian actors, and using Italian sceneries and backgrounds and various tropes. And then we kind of picked up on that and started doing peplums, imitating the American approach. We see that with the Westerns, pre Sergio Leone. And after which we have a second generation of directors, or sometimes even just one director, that kind of changes completely things by having one massive, incredibly important success. We see it with Sergio Leone, we see it with Dario Argento with The Giallo, we see it with a lot of different directors and within different genres. And basically what happens there then is that we have directors that manage to find new voices and new approaches and approaches is the right word, and kind of make the genre them, kind of they suit them, they sew the genre on themselves. We see it with, for example, in Westerns, after Leone, we see directors like Tonino Valeri, Alberto De Martino, Castellari, Corbucci, Petroni, and so many others doing really original work. But after that, we find that the industry implodes. Producers start producing that genre in mass quantity, so much so that a way has to be found out of that mess that gets created, that saturation of the market. And then we see the various different filoni kind of, they branch out into various directions. For example, staying on Westerns, we see by 1966, 67, 68, we have political insurrection, students start to protest. We've got in 1968 the bombing of Piazza Fontana, and the Western reacts by becoming extremely political. We see Damiano Damiani directing Quen Sabe, we see Petroni directing Viva la Rivolución, Te Pepa, and also other films, Vamos a Matar Compañero, So Cangasiero. And so it's as if the genre twitches, it moves, it reacts to what's happening. But after at the end of it all, because of that saturation, because the market can't hold that quantity and the quality of the work starts lowering so much, the only possible way out is comedy. We see it with the Poliziesco, we see it with Westerns, and that's the last filone, because once you've laughed at something, you can't take that back. You can't take that genre seriously again. Once you've laughed at something, you've taken away its power. And so that's the last filone. So basically, the birth of filone is a reaction to society, to the political life of the country, but also to it trying to survive its own virus, this own saturation of the market, this overloading. So filoni are a comment and an attempt to survive itself. Mm-hmm. The genre tries to survive like a virus that looks for a new host.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a transformation and adaptation to new circumstances, you would say.
Exactly. All right. It is exactly that.
Yeah, because in the genre theory at the moment, we are speaking of a fluidity of genre concepts, and transformation is one of those concepts, and hybridity as well. You see some hybrid genre films in Italian cinema as well, like a ghost western, like the one with Klaus Kinski.
Are you talking about... pray the dead and kill the alive. Prega il morto e ammazza il vivo.
No, the one by Antonio Margheriti.
And
Dio disse a Caino. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. That's a brilliant film.
Yeah, Satan der Rache is the German title. And so we have similar phenomena which are also in like American genre as well, but it's very interesting that you say that the reaction of genre cinema on political circumstances is so significant for Italian cinema. Yeah. So that totally makes sense. And when we discussed the film Cruising in our book, I came up with the idea that Cruising is very much connected to Italian giallo thrillers. So giallo is a phenomenon which started in the early 60s, is somehow connected to the Edgar Wallace films as well, but has a life of its own, beginning with probably Dario Argento's film Bird with a Crystal Plumage in 1970. And is considered a certain Italian style of thriller. So when I came up with the idea that Cruising has the some elements or some stylistic and narrative elements which you also see in giallo films. I called it a kind of a global giallo. So the idea is that giallo is not only an Italian phenomenon, but also a phenomenon which you see in world cinema in several traditions, like also with Alfred Hitchcock's film Frenzy in England or in other countries, and also with Brian De Palma's films, for example. And so why do you think the Italian giallo thriller, the Italian idea of making a thriller, is so influential till today? Do we have an idea why that is? What is so special about this? And at the same time, the Italian phrase giallo is used differently in Italy, isn't it?
It is. Basically, well, to answer the first question, I would say that the great appeal of the giallo genre internationally, it's the fact that what giallo does so well in that it kind of poses as reality, but it becomes something else. We never expect, I mean, fans of giallo, and by the way, by giallo, we mean the 1970s, so let's say from 1971 onwards. Mm-hmm. Although there are some examples of pretty kind of subversive and very modern gialli of the 60s,
yep.
But the giallo, the Italian giallo of the 60s is kind of tends more towards the Clouseau, French approach, the Guarieri and the Umberto Lenzi films are a bit more mm-hmm. classical. They're based in reality, often in the bourgeois, very kind of upper class, but also bourgeois kind of scenarios and interactions. There's often money and sex involved. And by the 1970s, giallo becomes another word. That's why one of the biggest kind of diatribes between fans is, you know, is that giallo also a horror film? You know, where does a giallo stop being a giallo and becomes a horror film? Is Deep Red a giallo or a horror film? You know, because, and the reason there is this debate is because gialli, most of the gialli, have a surreal element to it, which makes it so that, first of all, it's exportable much more than many other genres, exportable everywhere. And it becomes a comment on cinema itself. It becomes a world where cinematic kind of tricks and effects and it could never be written. It's never a story that could be written. Giallo, if a giallo gets a good giallo from the 1970s gets written, it becomes stale. It dies. It's a genre that can only be cinema. It's a kind of approach that is only cinema because it plays with the medium. It's smoke and mirrors. It's the magician. It's that. It's a spectacle. That's why also the limits of some gialli become of some films, maybe poorer films, films with lesser budgets, actually still work because maybe a stinted dialogue, a kind of a very flat dialogue or an unconvincing actor still works because it's all so surreal. The packaging is so otherworldly. So I think that's one of the great appeals. I think that, well, giallo in Italian, yes, it's very different. It depends on the context. I mean, giallo we use simply to say a mystery story.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically it. It can be Murder, She Wrote with Angela Lansbury. Those are gialli. It can be anything. By adding giallo all'italiana and referring to films, then we're more specific. And then we're talking about the films of Dario Argento, of Antonio Bido, Luciano Ercoli, and, you know, all that generation, those various generations of directors. But again, also Gialli. I mean, we see Gialli everywhere, even in the 90s. I mean, you said And God Said to Cain. That's a perfect example. That's a giallo. There's a very giallo feel to it. And speaking of Filoni, for example, in the Western genre, we see various attempts to kind of branch into the giallo before Dario Argento. We're talking about pre-Dario Argento. My grandfather directed a film which wasn't particularly successful, although has become somewhat of a cult item, called The Nest of Vipers, also known as Night of the Vipers, or Night of the Viper, or Night of the Serpent, has various titles, with Luke Askew. And that again is a giallo, and it revolves around a murder and various mysteries that have to be resolved. So we actually see giallo trying to break through in the form we'll later know, even before Dario Argento. Dario Argento will really give it a shape and give it rules and give it kind of a sense of direction. But then, you know, there are various directors. I think with giallo, Sergio Martino, for example, has only recently, in the past few years, has begun to really get the credit he deserves. I think Sergio Martino has a voice onto his own, and is not at all derivative of Dario Argento, I find, and I think it's pretty unjust to just label him as many have, especially in the 90s and until recently, just labeled as a poor man's Dario Argento. Actually, I think that's very it's not seeing the full picture. In fact, I think he has a very specific kind of approach to the genre.
The interesting thing is that Martino has a different approach to the spaces, to the locations where his films take place. They are very specific, like the one taking place in Vienna, The Strange Vices of Signora Ward. And so he makes different use, while Argento is very interested in a kind of modernistic place, which could be everywhere, which is kind of a surreal place in a way. His Rome does never look like Rome, for example, beginning with a film like Bird with a Crystal Plumage and ending with Tenebrae, for example. It's more of a surreal state of things. And Martino has a different, more realist approach, probably. And I've seen a podium discussion with Martino, and he spoke about Il Gialli di Casa Martino. So, because they were produced in a family business as well, and they were produced in a row, and it's kind of he has his own complex in Italian genre film history.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the Martino brothers, Sergio and Luciano, are responsible. You know, if you put together all their work, it's pretty incredible. Dania was a factory that just, you know, churned out films after films. And Dania was not only a production company, it was also a distribution company. And they're responsible for an incredible, a ridiculous amount of films. But, you know, I think going back to what you were saying about the locations chosen by Martino and the ones instead by Argento, Argento did something which was perceived as not fully credible before, which was setting his films in Italy. There was this perceived notion until the late 60s, and this is confirmed also by Umberto Lenzi, by Sergio Martino, there's a very long interview in my book with him. All of them admit that one of the reasonings behind picking foreign, for Spanish, French, sometimes even German or Austrian settings was the fact that not so much internationally, but nationally in Italy, these films wouldn't. The Italian policeman, the Italian detective, the commissioner, was not perceived as credible because the iconography of the police force was very much molded until that point on the Commedia all'Italiana.
Yeah,
so
I see.
The kind of the unibrow carabiniere, that kind of clumsy and doesn't really understand much, and kind of the police that, you know, don't exactly are not like the Americans, you know, they're a different system, and the poking, the systematic poking fun of that reality on beside of the commedia, the various comedies all'italiana, the so-called commedia all'italiana, but not only, made it not perfectly credible. What happened, and this we see a parallel between the giallo and the crime films and polizieschi, is that by the late 1960s, the Italian world, the Italian political world, and also social, of course, various substrates changed radically with the bombing of Piazza Fontana and with the student revolts and with everything that was happening, with the Communist Party clashing with the Christian Democrats, which were and the other kind of big political power at the time. Italy began entering the so-called years of lead. And so a lot of there were various terrorist coups and terrorist groups, left-wing, but especially right-wing. The Italian society was perceived, and people in Italy perceived Italy as a frightening place. Italy was not anymore this kind of bucolic, reassuring postcard kind of reality we had seen in Roman Holiday. Yeah. Italy was a dangerous place where people could get killed on the street. Journalists who wrote articles that were not perceived as acceptable politically were shot. There was systematic bombings throughout the decade. And so we see this shift both in giallo and in polizieschi, so both where the police has a big function. All of a sudden, it's okay. All of a sudden, Italy has such a darkness to it that we can make films in Italy of this kind. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, genre cinema is reacting to the perception the common man has of his own country.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting aspect, even when looking back, which films became well-known from this complex, which examples are always referred to, and which had this international appeal, probably. And for me, I learned a lot from these films about Italy, probably more so than from visiting Italy with my parents as a child. What you say is exactly that, to get a consciousness about how serious some of the problems, the economic problems between North and South. I learned more from probably a Fulci film than from news or anything else. So it's very interesting how, coming back to your main idea in the beginning, that genre cinema in Italy reflects the reality of Italian society and presence. So coming to the end of our talk, why do you think did the very successful and very effective and huge Italian cinema industry died during the early 80s?
Well, this is one of the things I go back to very often in my book, for example, and I asked all the directors.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of reasons. I think that on one side, the fact that we didn't really have an industry. It's like that joke, you know, about in paradise. You know, the Italians are the ones that cook everything, and in hell they organize everything. You know, so it's a bit like that. It was a completely layered, disorganized proto-pseudo industry where everything kind of flourished and grew. It was I use this metaphor in the book that it's a garden, but it's a garden without a garden. Everything grows everywhere. It's wild. And we are not like the Americans or the British. We basically just made the industry implode. So that's definitely one of the reasons, the fact that there was absolutely no organization. The fact that the transitioning, I mean, because the birth of television and generalist television, especially generalist television and modern television, put all European countries in deep crisis. Germany, Spain, I mean, you can confirm for Germany, of course. But in Italy, this hit hard, especially private broadcasting companies that all of a sudden bought, sometimes not exactly legally, just bought massive numbers of films, entire archives, and all of a sudden you could see loads of films on your television screen, and cinema somehow was not needed in that sense, because a big chunk of exploitation and genre cinema was a release valve, violence, sex, or subject matters that you could not see on anywhere else if not on the big screen. Mm-hmm. So the function of being a release valve in many ways for a big chunk of the population just vanished. That the reason to exist for so many films just vanished. That's why, in fact, we see also cinema in Italy transitioning to pornography. You know, a lot of cinemas in Italy, cinema theaters became porn theaters. Mm-hmm. And apart from this, we also see, of course, then the Silvio Berlusconi empire did not help, kind of saturated the market and started producing loads of films, though it didn't distribute. It had too much money for its own good. So, and there are various reasons. Also, a lot of political reasons. By the late 1980s, which was a moment in which we could have kind of set in motion a kind of a rebirth, by that time, various film commissions had been put in place by left-wing politicians that kind of made it so that the biggest producer of Italian films was the government. Mm-hmm. So the various Articoli 18, as they're called, and various film commissions basically decided what was worthy and what wasn't. And in fact, for most of the 90s, we see a government-funded cinema. And it's funny to actually go back. Well, funny is, of course, I'm being facetious. It's actually very sad to see film directors and many, Pasquale Festa Campanile, my grandfather himself, Massimo Franciosa, and many of, you know, the older generations go back and trying to get funded by the film commissions. Mm. And receiving big no's. No, we don't want you. So, you know, it's politics, it's television, it's a lack of organization, and, you know, it's a lot of things. It's extremely complex, and it's, of course, a shame. You know, we had the potential of picking ourselves up and proceeding, like the Spanish did, for example, or the British did. But we are unable to. We had a political system and a lack of structure within the industry that just didn't make it so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I think it's actually different in Germany. It's there's also a lot of state-funded films being produced in the 80s, 90s, and they changed the face of German cinema, and they coined the face, actually, but it worked. So we had always had kind of a working film production and still have, but it seems very different in that sense. But we actually never had this flourishing genre film production from the 60s, which faded during the 70s. There are examples, very interesting examples, like Jürgen Goslar or people who made films like in Italy. But at the same time, the focus was totally different. It became very much television based, and German television is very much under control of censorship. So the co-production with television in Germany always meant don't be too excessive, don't be too extreme. And even co-produced films, like there's a very famous German genre film director called Dominik Graf. He makes police films, gangster films, and he switched very much towards television. He's a huge fan of Italian cinema as well. He also is in, he wrote on Fulci and so on. And he made a film called Die Katze, The Cat, with Götz George, and which is a very stunning police gangster film. And it always was shown censored until it was re-released in the last years. But I only knew it in a censored version because it was co-produced by a television, and you saw it in a cut version on television. And so the face of German cinema and German genre cinema is totally different. And even during a time when it still flourished in Italy, but. Yeah, Eugenio, thank you very much for this insight. It's a very unique insight. You. Yeah,
it was a pleasure. And, anytime I'm available.
Very good. And we will do things in future together for sure. And we are already planning if people want to know or not. And we'll be writing on film history and film aesthetics in future as well. And for all people who are interested in the subject, buy the book Darkening the Italian Screen by Eugenio Arcolani. You will find it on Amazon at least. And we heard why Italian genre cinema still matters, and thank you very much, and bye-bye.
Bye.